Good evening.
Is that working?
Yeah. It's very uplifting and moralizing to be here. Thank you to the organizers. When you organized this, you didn't know that I will be coming from the United States, where we deal with a new set of monsters. Some of them are very colorful, especially the orange one. Today, I want to build upon some of the conversations that were started by Lawrence about rethinking past, migration, oceans, and the futures, and talk about a crucial moment in European borderlands, in the Ottoman lands of Greece to Turkey, a crucial moment from 1914 to 1924, when empires, at least one empire, the Ottoman Empire, collapsed, giving birth to multiple nations, but more importantly, nations with homogeneous populations. And I want to go back to this formative period, not in the mode of a restorative nostalgia, as Lawrence mentioned, but as a reflective one. I didn't think any of the organizers have any nostalgia for the past empires. I think the mode is to rethink the roots and the origins of the nation-state order, to see how it emerged, and what possibilities, what futures were lost in that imagination, in that transition. That happened very sudden in the context of war, at least in the story that I will tell you. Because the story that I will tell you starts with the perilous journey that that many of the Syrian migrants have to take to go to Greece. And I want us to think that the host society, Greeks themselves, have been through that journey just less than 100 years ago, from 1914 to 1924, about 1 million Greeks moved from Anatolia, from the Ottoman lands, to contemporary Greece. At the same time, around the same time, about 1 million Muslims moved from Greece to contemporary Turkey. And that's part of the compassion, probably, that the Greeks welcoming Syrians, who were part of the same empire, is that their grandparents have been through that journey, have been through that suffering. What does happen is that today, we see this separation of Muslims and Greeks as something very natural, that something that happened inevitably. That we do not imagine, for example, a Muslim Greece, where there were hundreds of mosques in Athens or all over Greece. Or we also don't hardly imagine a Greek Turkey, where even in 1914, there were about 1 million Greeks. In Turkey, they were imagining their future as part of an empire. In the aftermath of World War I, if you take 1919 as a kind of turning point, within 5 years of 1919, the idea of a nation state was offered as a solution, an idea of a homogeneous, monolithic nation offered as a solution, a medicine that was supposed to cure the pains of empires, multi-ethnic, multi-religious empires that people thought, at least in the case of the Ottoman Empire, didn't work. But that magic pill extended to the rest of the world, proven to be highly poisonous, creating millions of shattered lives by justifying countless cases of ethnic cleansing, genocide, and population transfers. Thus, we see a dilemma, a kind of a paradox, that the 20th century history, the history that is supposed to symbolize the triumph of liberal ideas of self-determination and nationalism, actually has been more violent. And this is not accidental, that there are more shattered lives in the 20th century history than any period in the past. What I want to do is to actually go back to that moment and to invite all of us to think that the nation state wasn't inevitable, and we should not allow the nationalism to have a monopoly over the historical narratives of 1919. And I want to go back to two alternatives that suppressed political imaginations. One is the story of the cosmopolitan empires, the story of Muslims, Armenians, Greeks, Arabs, as well as Indians, both Hindu and Muslim, who imagined that their future would be a part of a reformed empire rather than nationalist separation. And I want us to think about the idea of a reformed empire that will give people rights, racial equality. Take that seriously, that imagination seriously, which I think we, over time, from World War I to World War II, people give up on that idea of reformed empire. A second one was already mentioned by Lawrence and others, is the idea of pan-nationalism, of pan-Asianism, pan-Africanism, and pan-Islamism. And in this case, I want to focus on pan-Islamism that is related to the Ottoman Empire, because during the time of the story that I will tell you, the Ottoman Empire had a caliph, and the majority of the Muslims in the world looked up to that caliph. And Rana was mentioning how we ended up having no utopia anymore. And it's reduced to either utopia of capitalism, markets, or self-destructive, nihilistic dystopia of ISIS. And many people complain that the Middle East doesn't seem to have anybody who is offering any utopia. What we can do, I think part of the reason why we don't have a good conversation on alternative political imaginations is that nationalist order in the 20th century created an extraordinary monopoly of historical narratives, trying to convince the citizens of their nation states that there was no other options, that the story of moving away from 50 empires plus nation states to 200 nations today was the only option available, and there is no other alternatives today. What I would like to tell you that this transition did not happen after some sort of a conversations globally among different parties about what options we have, what can we do. It actually happened because of wars, like World War I, World War II, the decisions made during wars that created irreversible moves that were later justified in moral terms. And I would like to end, that's why, with a man named Fridtjof Nansen, who received Nobel Prize for Peace for actually unmixing the populations of Greece and Turkey. And I want us to think why someone who would actually force Muslims from Greece to come to Turkey and Christians, Greek Christians from Turkey to go to Greece, will actually receive a Nobel Prize for it. A move that we consider today criminal, that you will be put on trial in Hague. That's the story of a Swedish international lawyer and diplomat, Fridtjof Nansen, who thought that he found the magic solution to the crisis of empire. And this way, I also want to finally kind of tell a little bit of a different story about the caliphate, which is part of the story that we are all familiar with, the story of clash of civilizations. We think that the Ottoman Empire was an Islamic empire, an evil caliphate ruling and oppressing Christians, and it was natural that all of these Christians would actually want freedom and separation from the Ottomans, and try to make sense why not only Christians in the Ottoman Empire will look up to the caliphate as some sort of a reformed caliphate, an empire, as part of their future, but why Hindus in India, like Mahatma Gandhi, or many other Hindus, and many Muslims in India, or in the French Empire, will look up to that caliphate not as a model to oppress and suppress Christian minorities, but as a model of a multicultural cosmopolitan empire that give Christian minorities freedom, a freedom that Muslims in other empires didn't have, and how that story became reversed. Before I do these things in the next 20 minutes, I want to kind of set the puzzle with this moment of 1908 when the Ottoman Empire had a constitution. And on the left, you see a postcard, a Greek postcard celebrating 1908 revolution in the Ottoman Empire, where the Ottoman, the lady who symbolizes the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman nationalities, is freed from its chains, and there's a constitution and a parliament. And in the background, there are Armenians, Greeks, and Turks, who all seem to wear a fez, which is now seen as a symbol of Islam, but originally a symbol of kind of Mediterranean cosmopolitanism with some strong Greek roots. And I want to kind of pay attention to the map of the empire in 1908 that included today's northern Greece, Macedonia, Albania, the part of Europe today, which was still part of the Ottoman Empire at that time, as well as the Middle East going down. Many people in 1924 who were forced out of their homes to move across the Aegean Ocean, either as Greeks from Anatolia going to today's Greece, and Muslims in Greece forced to come to Turkey in 1924 or before, from 1912 to 24. If you ask them, could you go back to 1908? What would you do? Would you choose 1908 over 1924? I could say that many of them would have chosen 1908. They had their home, they had their own place, but they were forced, they didn't have the agency at some point to actually reverse the clock to go back. What was in that clock? What was happening? And for that, I need to mention a couple of corrections in our mind, is that the Ottoman Empire's cosmopolitanism need to be taken seriously. Many of us in Europe and America struggle with this narrative of clash of civilization, that the Ottoman Empire is seen as this threatening empire in the Battle of Vienna. That is the empire that came from Mecca, some sort of Islam. And Europe is Christian, obviously, and there's always a clash of civilization. And there's nothing redeemable about the empire. Well, start with the Battle of Vienna. In 1683, when the Ottoman Empire was fighting with the Habsburgs in Battle of Vienna, they had as many Christians under their rule as Muslims. The Ottoman army was composed of 30% Christian forces. Moreover, Battle of Vienna was never a clash between Islam and Christianity. In fact, the Ottoman Empire's goal is to protect the Hungarian Protestants from Catholics. So a battle that is done between Protestants and Catholics for the sake of empire is now remembered, not only all over Europe, but also in America and Islamicate world, as a battle between Islam and Christianity. More importantly, I want to also raise attention to this one great symbol of Ottoman cosmopolitanism, the coffee houses. Many of us enjoy our daily dose of coffee without thinking that it had a very Ottoman roots. It's the first coffee consumption by Yemeni Muslims, Sufis. And we think Yemen is kind of outside of the global networks of modernity, but they had the signature, and there are Palestinian Jews are involved in this. Syrian Arabs were the first inventors of the coffee house. And then that coffee house was taken by Armenian and Jewish merchants to Europe to create the idea of a European modernity, the kind of a space where people get together outside of the influence of the church or synagogue or a mosque to think about ideas. So many people make a clear connection between coffee houses and European enlightenment. But the coffee houses, the Ottoman roots, in these pictures you can see one in Istanbul, one in Cairo. The Cairo one, kind of you drink coffee around the Nile in the boats. Shows that this cosmopolitanism had a social space, had a life. It needs to be taken seriously on that level in the marketplace or in entertainment and music. Muslims and Greeks and Armenians had a coexistence, and their political imagination had to be taken seriously. In that regard, I want to move on to another point, is that the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, when they were competing with other empires, reformed itself by giving Christians and Jews legal equality, which is a very important turning point, that the empire did not actually tax Christians and Jews. And there was one important reason for that, is that the Ottomans inherited a Mongolian imperial legacy, the legacy of Genghis Khan. The Ottoman sultans were also called Khan, Caesar, Sultan. And in the imperial logic they have is that the emperor is above everybody else and everybody under it can be equal. Now, I want to qualify this, is that as a Muslim living in America, I know that you can have a legal equality, but the white supremacy will continue. African Americans will always tell us that we have civil rights movements and legal equality, but that doesn't mean that African Americans are equal to whites. So you can imagine that even though 19th century Ottoman Empire reinvented itself, giving legal equality to Armenians and Greeks, but then there could be some sort of a Muslim supremacy in the empire, that the dynasty was Muslim. But that doesn't mean that the Greeks and Armenians immediately wanted a separation, that they could still use that notion of legal equality to reform the empire. If this is the case, then how did we get to this? And I will get to this. How did they get the Muslims involved in this story? The one last point I want to make is that in the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire only rules over 20% of the world's Muslims. The rest of the Muslims are actually ruled by European empires. And they have, and the woman who actually ruled more Muslims than any other monarch in world history was Queen Victoria. And that's a picture of Queen Victoria with her Muslim servant. Well, she never called him a servant. Muslim instructor, Munshi, she called. His name is Abdul Karim. And for the last 10 years of Queen Victoria's life, Abdul Karim was a very important person. He cooked halal curry in the Buckingham Palace. He had his own prayer space. And that makes sense in terms of Queen Victoria's image of the Queen, Empress of India. That makes sense. She is the greatest Muslim monarch in the world in that sense, that they rule over about 100 million Muslims. And that doesn't mean, of course, Muslims and Hindus are completely content with empire, that they might have their own discontent. But the conjunction that I want to indicate is this imperial dilemma and the tension that on the one hand, empires claim inclusion, equality, universality that Queen Victoria or the Ottoman Sultan could present, but on the other hand, empires also overcome by racial distinction. So if there are more Hindus and Muslims in the British Empire and less Christians and whites, how do whites in the empire assert their privilege, their position? And these tensions are already there without any clarity where it will end. It's in that context we need to also think of the kind of biographical careers of people like Mahatma Gandhi, who initially fought for equality of colored people within the empire before he became the leader of a nationalist movement. And for Indian Muslims, the story becomes even more interesting is that British Empire empowered and gave Indian Muslims new connections to the Middle East and the Ottoman Empire through steamships, telegraphs, unintentionally, the grid. And in that context, Indian Muslims, once they lost their empire, they became part of the British Empire without being anti-imperialist. They asserted some sort of a tie to the Ottoman Sultan, a spiritual tie to the Ottoman Sultan, to claim that a Muslim could also be a civilized monarch. And this is the birth of the idea of the Muslim world that I wrote a book on. It's out in my publicity for that book. But I want to go back to this, is that Indian Muslims from 1890s to 1920s, when they were asserting as Muslims their ties to the Ottoman Empire, they would often present a list like that. So the list talks about the Christian officials in the Turkish administration and writes all the Greeks and Armenian ministers and ambassadors, and be very proud of it. And we need to remember that moment where people who are advocating for Muslims respecting the caliphate, actually liking the caliphate, because caliphate is more inclusive than the British Empire. And they will, after making such list of counting all the Armenians and Greeks in the Ottoman administration, they will also note that where are the Hindu or Muslim bureaucrats and administrators, not only in London, but even in the administration in India. For those people in 1908 or 1914, just before World War I, the future political imagination didn't look necessarily a nationalist separation, even though there was a lot of expression of discontent. Discontent, especially about racial hierarchies and distinctions. This is the age of Anglo-Saxon racial superiority. There's also discontent about economic issues. There's a discontent about political rights, good governance. So when did all of these discontents were channeled to a nationalist path? And I would argue that the process, the very negative process, starts not in 1908, but in World War I. Just on the eve of World War I, there was this war between small Christian Balkan states and the Ottoman Empire, where at the end of which, lots of Muslims were expelled from Europe. So the idea of Europe is a land of Christians and Muslims shouldn't live there happened just on the eve of World War I. But I think the real turning point was 1914 in World War I. For various reasons, the alignment, the imperial alliances were formed in a way that the Ottoman Empire was with Germany, Britain, France, and Russia were together. And in this context, I want to indicate this illusion or delusion of this holy war probably prepared in cooperation between this city and Istanbul. This holy war was not the only holy war of World War I. That during the war, empires, in order to weaken the other empires, used nationalism as a tool. While the Ottomans were asking Indian Muslims and Hindus to revolt against the British Empire, which they weren't until that point, Britain also asked the Armenians and then Arabs, in the case of Lawrence of Arabia, to revolt against the Ottoman government. These revolts, these imperial instrumentalization of nationalism and ideas of liberty and justice led to some disastrous policy decisions. At the peak of World War I, when there were many Muslims in the British army and there were many Christians in the Ottoman army fighting against each other in Gallipoli, the Ottoman government, out of their own paranoia and fear, decided to relocate Armenian populations from Anatolia to Syria, which led to the massacres and ethnic cleansing. And this moment I want to remember that happened when there were Armenians in the Ottoman army fighting for the Ottoman cause. And we need to remember both sides. At the same time, Britain, France, together, they had a plan to carve the Ottoman Middle East with very disastrous policy conclusions. One of them are Syzygy, making this division between Syria, Iraq. The other is the Arab revolt that is under British encouragement starting. But third, last but not least, is an important one, is also promising a Muslim-majority Palestine to as a Jewish homeland without consulting to the native populations in that area, the Arab population. Now, one issue that before I conclude, I want us to remember that this moment of Balfour Declaration, which is a very messianic moment, it has some sort of anti-Semitic implications on the side of the British too, happened when there were millions, well, hundred thousands of Muslims fighting for the British Empire. And their critique was that how come world's greatest Muslim empire, the British Empire, which Churchill, Lord Curzon, called over and over that we are the world's greatest empire, France is the world's greatest second greatest empire, we should tell this to Latin, second greatest Muslim empire. I think Le Pen should remember that. This was happening at the same time, so you can see the wartime double standard policies that actually is the cause behind all this nationalist carving of the world and reordering empires according to the logic of population transfer and national divisions. It's in this context, after 1919 Paris Peace Conference, British encouraged Greece to invade Anatolia because the Ottoman Empire lost the war. So there's this image that suddenly the Greek populations felt like after Armenians were expelled, they can't feel secure. They need to have a different political imagination. I think this happened during the war, not before. But after the war, Greek populations then have to welcome Greek army invading Anatolia, and even there was Greek navy coming to Istanbul. Now, what is lost and forgotten in that moment are two points, is that at the moment of Woodrow Wilson and Vladimir Lenin, the greatest mass movement in the world at that time was a movement called Khilafat movement. These are Indian Muslims, including Hindus, campaigning to pressure London to keep its promises that they weren't supposed to invade Istanbul or invade holy cities of Arabia, Muslim holy cities. They were supposed to respect the rights of Muslims in the Ottoman Empire and other places. And this connection between Indian Muslims and Hindus and the Turkish War of Independence actually enabled Mustafa Kemal Atatürk to renegotiate the kind of Versailles Treaty that is signed for the Ottoman Empire, to sign the Lausanne Treaty and create the current national borders of contemporary Turkey. So without Indian Muslims, these Turkish borders would not be the same. So you can imagine how Turkey benefited from the political imagination of Indian Muslims' links. And this is the picture of the Lausanne Treaty that is signed and the current borders. But what is important is this, I think, is that at this point, Fridtjof Nansen enters into the scene at Lausanne Treaty. And he says that for Eastern Europe, where people are civilized, we can have a minority protection regime, that the minorities can be protected internationally. And there's, of course, the hierarchy of civilization there, that they are civilized. But for the Ottoman lands, minority protection wouldn't work because there is too much blood already spilled from 1914 to 1919. Thus, he recommends, for very humanitarian purposes, to uproot all the Christian Greeks from Anatolia and force them to move to Greece with the help of Red Crescent, Red Cross societies, and in return, exchange them with the Muslim populations in Greece, forced to go to Turkey. And this is highly traumatic, and two people who love this, who became very good friends, Republic's founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, then the president of Greece, Venizelos. They visited each other, and this is a picture on the right from 1930s. In fact, Venizelos later on wanted to nominate Atatürk for a Nobel Peace Prize. So this separation could have gotten two Nobel Prizes instead of one, in addition to Nansen. But what's the reason of remembering this? Why is it important? Remember this for several reasons. One, for imperial cosmopolitanism. And I wrote in my text, was there a cosmopolitanism baby thrown out of with the bathwater of empire? And I want to pose this question in a reflective mode, not in a nostalgic mode. I think if we reflect on it, we may find to revive some of the roots of that cosmopolitanism that can be part of the imperial setting, the new post-colonial setting. So when the current mayor of London was elected as the first Muslim mayor of London, everybody was saying, how great it is. There's a Muslim mayor of London. I mean, but isn't that so natural? The British Empire's Muslim status is so overwhelming. There had to be a Hindu mayor or a Muslim mayor. Even 100 years ago, it should have been very normal, but it wasn't. And we need to naturalize this by actually telling a very different story. A second one, beyond the exchange, is this question of the caliphate. What happened to the caliphate in 1924? This has, of course, is very important repercussions for Muslim political imaginations, because the caliphate, which was abolished by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in 1924, was tied initially to a cosmopolitan empire, was in a way endorsing an imperial world out there, but telling the imperial world to treat the Muslims and other colored people equally. It was kind of a break on the balance on the racism of the imperial world, not an anti-imperial force. But it became so much entangled with the international geopolitics of World War I, Germans declaring jihad with the Ottomans, and it's being used by the Indian Muslims to pressure London, that it lost its geopolitical value and as part of some sort of Turkish, new Turkish national sovereign design, that Atatürk didn't want a caliph in Istanbul. He also pursued that as a threat. So it was abolished. Indian Muslims who mobilized everything to pressure London actually suddenly lost that card. And we have to think about the gap that was created by that abolishment in 1924 and its implication for today. That when we are actually fighting against some of the fundamentalist ideologies, we have to understand that these were products of the Cold War and nationalism itself. The idea of ISIS's caliphate in Syria or in Iraq are expelling or oppressing Christians does not come from an historical legacy of caliphate governance. It has more to do with nationalism than Muslim political thought, because 100 years ago, a different caliphate was claiming to do the opposite, and then things turned around. So in conclusion, I will say that let's not surrender our political imagination to the logic of nationalism and population transfer. Let's try to think differently. A different world is possible. And I think we need that different imagination today more than any other time. Thank you.